And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpits, here's Nick Perez.
That's right, you can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West. This is Live from the Pulpit, coming to you live and local, on location from deep in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, deep in the heart of Davis Park Church of Christ in Modesto, California. I'm your guide on this excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offering up news and views you can use on scripture and society with a little hope for my friends. Greetings, welcome to the program, glad you tuned in. Sponsor this half hour, Davis Park Church of Christ, located at 901 West Rumble Road here in Modesto, California. Davis Park Church of Christ is composed of people who have received the mercy of God, people who are focused upon the mission of God, and people who engage in ministry for God. Davis Park meets every Lord's Day, that's Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m., morning worship at 10:45 a.m. We also meet for midweek Bible study every Wednesday at 7 p.m. We hope you stop by and visit us sometime. She's served by her preaching minister, yours truly, as well as her outreach minister, Buddy Gray. Visit DavisParkChurchModesto.com for more information. Davis Park Church of Christ, making a difference one person at a time. If God is so concerned about us obeying His will, why doesn't He reveal His will more plainly? Sometimes you hear people ask that question, or it may be phrased differently, but at the heart of the question is a longing for God to speak. If only God spoke today. And this question also revolves around another question of, is God silent? The God most people want today would be a vocal God, a God who speaks often, unmistakably. What most people want, they don't even realize it, is they want the God of the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, we see a God who is vocal, a God who is speaking nearly daily in some instances. And He speaks His will, and His will is unmistakable. The people of Israel are a good case study of this. Should we pack up and move? Or should we stay put? Well, all they had to do was glance over at the tabernacle to see if the cloud had moved. I'm talking about the wilderness wanderings. They had round the clock, up to the minute updates concerning God's will. They had the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day. They had 613 laws regulating just about any scenario that you could think of, ranging from murder to boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. And even in the supposed quote-unquote gray areas, they had the Urim and the Thummim to determine the definite will of God. God, in the Old Testament, whatever you want to say about the God of the Old Testament, right? People think about God in those terms, God of the Old Testament, God of the New Testament, all that stuff. Whatever you want to say about God in the Old Testament, God was not silent. In fact, He was the God that most people want today. Vocal, speaking constantly, daily, clearly, unmistakably, and yet, with all of this, Israel still was not doing God's will. They were still disobedient. God tells them His will. He speaks verbally. He speaks plainly to them. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 19 through 33. God tells them, go take the promised land. I'm giving you the land. Go take it. But they balk at this. He tells them, go fight the Amorites. Still Deuteronomy chapter 1, this time verses 41 to 46. And Israel goes, they fight, they are beaten down. They had the law, again with 613 other laws clarifying specifics. And yet Israel invented ways of breaking God's heart. He tells them in Jeremiah 19 and verse 5, 32 verse 35, that they did stuff that hadn't even entered the mind of an omniscient God. You did stuff never even entered my mind. They became, as Paul describes it in Romans 1 and verse 30, inventors of evil. So no, the problem was not the silence of God generally or even specifically. Examples could be multiplied regarding God speaking, not remedying the problem. And so I believe when it comes to the problem of the silence of God, it's not the silence of God generally or even specifically, because we do have His Word. We have the Bible. And it is very clear about what God desires of us. No, our issue is a personal one. Why does God seem silent with me? And I believe that's where a lot of people are. The silence of God, personal. That's where most people struggle and question and wonder. Say something. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And they end up with silence. I want you to imagine that God answered all of our questions about the why and the wherefore of suffering. Because that's usually where when people ask the question is when they're hurting, when they're suffering, when there's pain in their life. They want God to speak, and they wonder why He's silent. I want you to imagine God answered all of our questions about the why and the wherefore of suffering in detail. Even in a technical manner, He just broke it down, addressed all of our questions. Now here's the question. Would we bear up under suffering better if we knew why God did this and why God allowed suffering? We assume we would, by the way, but would we? Especially given the multiplied examples of God speaking and people not listening. Think of Lamentations. Jeremiah, the prophet, Jerusalem, the people of Israel, they're suffering. It's a dark scene. The city has been burned down. Women have been raped. Children have been killed. People have been enslaved, even the Lord's people. And they knew exactly why God had done this. They knew exactly what the cause of their suffering was. It was sin. Lamentations 1 and verse 8, Jerusalem sinned grievously. Therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She groans and turns her face away. It's because of sin. Now here's the question. Was the pain that they were suffering and enduring, was the pain lessened because they knew why God had allowed such intense suffering to fall upon them? Did the suffering suddenly cease because of the knowledge? Was the burden of calamity and disaster easier to bear because they knew the causation? No. Would enlightenment help us? Could it be then that God is silent because He knows enlightenment may not help us? So instead of an explanation, a detailed and technical explanation of the why of suffering, God simply comes and sits in silence with us in the midst of pain and suffering. Kind of like Job. You remember the story of Job? Patient Job? We have to trudge through 35 chapters of man's philosophical ponderings concerning the problem of evil. These friends of Job doing their best to develop a theodicy. 35 chapters before God shows up. And when God shows up, what do we expect? Well, we expect God will set the record straight. He's going to correct all the wrong-headed thinking about pain and suffering. And Job's friends were very wrong-headed in their thinking about why suffering, why Job was suffering and all that. That's what we expect God to do. Clear the air. Enlighten us. Help us to comprehend what's going on here. But God doesn't do that. Instead, God essentially tells Job, look, if you cannot tell me how the physical universe works, and that's a small thing, do not presume to tell me how the moral universe should work. Perhaps that's another reason why God is silent, is because he knows our finite minds are incapable of comprehending his answer, or his answers to the why question. He knows it would be like trying to explain what blue tastes like, or trying to explain color to a blind man, or Mozart to a deaf person, or 3D to the 2D inhabitants of Flatland. Enlightenment may not be of help to us. Our ability to comprehend may fail us. But then there's another question that I wonder about, and it's, would we even like the answers? Think about Abraham, father of the faithful. Abraham, at 75, he's called by God to follow God by faith. He's given a promise of a nation as numerous as the sand of the sea or the stars of the heaven. And all this happens as a flash of light. Brilliant revelation from God. And then that flash of light is followed by darkness for silent darkness for 25 years. Finally, a son is born, Isaac. And then a few years later, a word comes from God, and it's, take your son, your one and only son, and go offer him as a sacrifice to God on Mount Moriah. And we know the story. He was willing to do it. In fact, we're told by the writer of Hebrews that Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. That if he did have to go through with it and kill his son Isaac, God would bring him back to life. But be honest. How many of us would be willing to do it? How many of us would be willing to go as far as Abraham did, as going to the place, tying up his son, laying him on the wood, raising the knife? How many of us would be willing to go to do that? How many of us would view God as a moral monster for asking something so heinous and horrible as sacrificing our own child? How many of us would hate God for making such a request? Some do. Perhaps God is silent because he knows we really wouldn't like what he says anyway. Now here's something to consider as well. The silence of God is typical in the lives of the faithful. No, it's typical for the faithful to experience the silence of God. Joseph dreams. Remember this. He has his dreams. And then he ends up in a pit and then in a prison. And there's no indication that God ever communicates to him anymore after that. How about Moses? Israel's God-chosen deliverer. He spends 40 years in the silent wilderness before God finally speaks to him from the burning bush. Remember that? How about David, God's anointed king? He spends years on the run from Saul with no indication that God was speaking to him. The silence of God, again, it's typical in the lives of the faithful. And so I would be wary today of anyone who claims regular, daily, verbal communication with God. In fact, it seems the kind of faith that God is looking for is not one constantly seeking a sign, but one that's devoted to God in spite of the silence. Philip Yancey's written a book. I pulled much of this material from one of the chapters in the book. If you want more information, the title of the book is Disappointment with God. But he makes this statement. He says, signs may only addict us to signs, not to God. So I want to kind of wrap up this session with a brief look at 1 Kings chapter 19 with a stop off in Psalm 29. In Psalm 29, when we think about the voice of God, we tend to think of Psalm 29. Psalm 29 is all about the voice of God, how mighty and thunderous the voice of God is. It's the voice of the Lord. Lord, all caps, tells us that that's Yahweh. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord, Yahweh, over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. You get the idea. This is a very powerful and apparently an audible thing, right? And that's what we want. That's what a lot of people want. They want the voice of Yahweh that breaks the cedars of Lebanon. But more often than not, what we get is what Elijah got in 1 Kings chapter 19. In this particular account, Elijah has fled, run off, in fear of his life from Jezebel. He goes out to Mount Horeb, the Mount of God, and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. And an angel shows up to him and gives him some food, and he's kind of, by all appearances, he's depressed. Well, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, and he asks him, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "You know, I've been jealous for you, Lord. But your people have forsaken you and your covenant. And I want to die." So God says, "Go outside. I want you to see this." And so what happens is that the Lord passes by. There's a great strong wind, and it breaks into pieces the mountain and the rocks. But the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, there's an earthquake, but the Lord's not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord's not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper is what my English standard says, but there's another translation that says the voice of gentle silence. And by all indications, that's what God was in. God was not in the mighty wind. He wasn't in the earthquake. He wasn't in the blazing fire. In other words, God is not always at work in visible and dramatic ways. Sometimes he does. Sinai. Yeah, Sinai, all the elements of that were present when God showed up and delivered his law. That's the God we want. We want the God of Sinai. with the hurricane force wind voice and the mountain shaking earthquake voice and the blazing intense fiery voice. But more often than not, what we get is the voice of gentle silence. God's voice is in the sound of silence. He chooses to be present silently. God can and He does work in ways which His servants can't even detect. So is God silent? Well, yes and no. Yes, in that God is not verbally, audibly speaking, but no, in that He is the voice of gentle silence. Perhaps a better question is, are we listening to God in the silence? Have we sufficiently quieted our souls to hear Him? Jesus says in John 10:27, "My sheep hear my voice." Will we turn down the noise and get comfortable in the silence so that we might hear God? The temptation is to flood ourselves with noise, a steady stream of wind, earthquake, and fire with podcasts and sermons. But maybe we just need to calm down and be silent and allow the Lord to fight for us. Today in church history, this is a difficult one because I forget which side of which branch of the church it is, whether it's the West or the East. But one of them celebrates, remembers the baptism of Jesus. I want to say it's the East. I could be mistaken about that, but Hippolytus, who was martyred in 236, wrote a sermon on or around this day. Many years ago. It's the East that typically celebrates the baptism of Jesus, and it's where the Holy Trinity was first publicly revealed. But in the sermon, Hippolytus envisions what happens in Matthew chapter 3 in the Gospel, where he says, "Hey, Jesus is saying, 'Baptize me, John, in order that no one may despise baptism. I am baptized by you, the servant, that no one among kings or dignitaries may scorn to be baptized by the hand of a poor priest. Allow me to go down into the Jordan in order that they may hear my Father's testimony and recognize the power of the Son.'" I like that. It's good stuff right there. I think there are too many people that they don't treat baptism with the dignity that it deserves and don't impress upon people's hearts and minds the importance of baptism. Hippolytus continues. He says, "Do you see, beloved, how many and how great blessings we would have lost if the Lord had yielded to the exhortation of John and declined baptism? For the heavens were shut before this. The region above was inaccessible. We would in that case descend to the lower parts, but we would not ascend to the upper. But was it only that the Lord was baptized? He also renewed the old man and committed to him again the scepter of adoption. For straightway the heavens were opened. A reconciliation took place of the visible with the invisible. The celestial orders were filled with joy. The diseases of earth were healed. Secret things were made known. Those at enmity were restored to amity. For you have heard the word of the evangelist saying, 'The heavens were opened to him on account of three wonders.' For when Christ the bridegroom was baptized, it was meet with the bridal chamber of heaven should open its brilliant gates. And in like manner also, when the Holy Spirit descended in the form of a dove and the Father's voice spread everywhere, it was meet that the gates of heaven should be lifted up. What does baptism teach us, and what does it effectually signify and convey by the grace of God? The Eastern Church typically answers everything. And so, it was on this day, approximately, 1,970. Well, no, it'd be more than that. Anyway, I can't do the math in my head. But it was on this day when Jesus was baptized by John.
And now it's time for the question of the day. This is the question of the day on Life from a Pulpit.
Does it matter if you are baptized as a baby or as an adult? Does it matter if you were baptized as a baby or as an adult? Yeah, I believe it does matter. Typically, babies that are baptized, they're not immersed. They're typically sprinkled, or they have water poured over their head. That's not a baptism. That's a sprinkling or a pouring. Baptism has a very specific meaning. Baptizo, the word in the original, has to do with immersion. And if they wanted to talk about being sprinkled or having water poured on their head, they had words for that, just like we do. But they use the word baptism, immersion. But more than that, also, it needs to be remembered that Jesus says that it is those who believe and are baptized that are saved. Faith must come into the picture, and babies do not have faith. Their parents may have faith, and they may have good intentions of wanting their child to be dedicated and devoted to the Lord, but if that's the case, it's incumbent upon them to raise them in the Lord, not for them to engage in some kind of ritual or ceremony. So there's the faith aspect, and babies, they don't have faith, and faith comes by hearing by the word of Christ. So yeah, as an adult or someone who's grown up and reached an age where they can understand and have faith in Christ, that's what makes baptism effectual. But also are the purposes of baptism. They need to be factored in here as well. Baptism is for the forgiveness of sin. We're told in Acts chapter 2 and verse 38. And quite frankly, babies are innocent. They have no sin. They've committed no sin and are not in need of having any sin forgiven. Whereas grown-ups, adults, people, even teenagers who have come to realize they've fallen under conviction of their sins, those are the ones who need their sins forgiven. And baptism, when coupled with faith on the part of a believing adult, that's when baptism should be administered, not upon babies. When it comes to this, again, if someone came to me and says, I was baptized as a baby, do I need to be rebaptized? I would say, yeah. And I believe there are a number of biblical factors that need to be considered here about the meaning, purposes, meaning and purposes of baptism, as well as baptism being the culmination or manifestation of faith in an individual. Faith being put into action, to say it another way. There are a number of factors. Does it matter if you're baptized as a baby? Yes, it does matter. And I would strongly counsel someone who was baptized as a baby to be baptized as an adult in order that their faith might be demonstrated and they might receive the forgiveness of their sins. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook Life from the Pulpit, like the Facebook page, and you'll get updates when I go live with the podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube Life from the Pulpit. Many of the questions of the day segments are there for you to use and peruse in your every Bible study. Follow me on Twitter at InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Same handle on Instagram. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Live from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular device, and you'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Be sure and stop at the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E, from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Philippians, Ephesians, stuff on the Psalms as well. Also, not secret, secret.wordpress.com is my other website with articles and my general writings. Check out Davis Park Church of Christ website, DavisParkChurchModesto.com, for more information. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.